Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You're tuned into Update. It's another beautiful Saturday morning. You've got the wonderful Anthony Blomfield, another fantastic show in all things technology. So thanks again for coming on in. Please text your friends. Quick, get out of bed. Tune in to the illustrious Anthony. You're going to get a great dose of technology today. Distract your mind. Good old Doctor Who theme. In the days of creative people being imaginative. So it's another interesting day. Wow, election day. Pretty exciting. Don't worry, I know all the rules around it. Can't tell you anything. But pretty interesting day. Sort of the funny little day, isn't it? So again, don't forget my website if you want to contact me or ask questions on how to get your laptop working. It's go to chat at update. Go to email chat at update.chat or go to the website. It's easier now. Just simply go to update.chat. And then there's a forum there. You can post messages, contact me. Yep, update.chat. And let's get into the show. So, again, people, we're going to basically be talking a couple of things. I'll tell you what we're going to be talking about in a second. But it's going to be pretty interesting. But before we do that, let's grab some technology news. So, people, what's going on in the big old tech world these days? SpaceX has launched their amazing satellites into space, which is going to be the internet for the world, Starlink. And some keen photographers have already been photographing them running across the horizon in New Zealand. And they're quite spectacular because they're clustered together in a long train. Okay, there's about 150 of them all comparatively close to each other, and you can see them in the night sky. I think it's every more than once a day will shoot across the sky in a big long train. So that's pretty interesting. And Starlink are allowing people who are really keen to bug test effectively their internet service, be a prototype tester, and you can apply to Starlink, or rather that's SpaceX if New Zealand, if you're out in the country or you're interested in getting the internet from space. So that's one. Apple released their iPhone 12. Quite frankly, nothing that exciting there. But what I think is interesting, might have been missed in the news, is Foxconn is really pushing into the electric car market. And this is pretty much what everyone was waiting for, quite frankly. Foxconn makes something like 70% of all consumer electronics. It's a mammoth of a company in China that makes lots of tech, and they are now getting in. You know, so all your laptops, they just pump them out for most companies around the world. Your iPhones, all of that is made in Foxconn. So now they're going to be producing electric cars, so that will potentially bring the cost down a lot. we've got, so that's pretty interesting. We got a few more things, and just bring that up there. Auckland Airport has just put in some soundproofing technology to not proofing, but cancelling technology to help the residents in the area. So that's interesting. They might be able to have the Concorde land there one day. And also, which is slightly interesting news, is New Zealand government's just signed up to bringing in facial recognition cameras to New Zealand, which I think is a really sad mistake. But that's what they're looking at doing. Well, not looking at doing, they're effectively getting a contract to do that, which is very stupid in my mind. But anyway, that's what they're looking at doing. So, yeah, let's get into the subject of today. I think it's much more interesting. So, yep, Anthony, update. Let's go. Right, so today's show is going to be pretty interesting. It's going to be about how does New Zealand be successful in technology? How do we, and not just successful in the sense of being good at it, but becoming rich out of it, making money. How can technology really help New Zealand go up the ladder a lot? And so I've got a whole lot of cool ideas, like I always do. You can always find me on the internet, Anthony Blomfield, LinkedIn, etc. But pretty much a trillion ideas in my little head. But let's go with, you know, for New Zealand to succeed in this world, this quite fairly interesting world of the technology, there's some things we definitely have to do. Can't be shy, and probably some better swoop pools we're going to have to swallow. But we do have some natural advantages to do very well in some areas of tech. And that's what I'm going to talk about, the areas that we naturally can do well if we really put our minds to it. And also, of course, we can do anything, but I'll talk about what we naturally can be quite good at and what we need to do and, you know, maybe the sort of things, conditions for being successful in tech. And I'll start with, I guess, the cruel bad news that I think if we don't admit this, we won't really start to get good at producing innovation or technology. And most of the country, the culture, we're very far behind. And I think we need to admit that. There are areas of success for sure, but as a country of producing world-beating widgets and gadgets and profitable products, we got to really, you know, stop wasting time. A lot of things that just are a waste of time. And go hard and be honest and be real. And that's probably something that, no more smoke and mirrors, that sort of thing. So, yeah. So, no more niceness. So, let's just go through a few things. And the reason this is a big deal for me is, you know, a bit of a Steve Jobs lover. And I always thought that Steve Jobs was this great pioneer that just pulled some great ideas out of his head, made some friends, and boom, there's Apple, which is now worth $2 trillion as one company, something like the size of the economy of half of Europe. Anyway, so how do you know? And I always thought Steve Jobs just basically came up, grabbed some ideas, you know, waddled away. I don't know, found some spare parts and made them, and then read his book, and it's a good book, and, you know, there's lots of books on Steve and stuff. But one of the things that really, I think, wasn't played up enough, and this is really important for New Zealand, is that the institutions were already in place in America to allow people like Steve, people of Steve's caliber, to naturally be, you know, produce, make money, turn an idea into a product. And those institutions were really big. And the culture was there, and it was almost like Steve was just a spark to a fire. And so that's where I think, as a culture, as New Zealand, I think for a long time it was all about just having an idea, and somehow that idea gets to the market. And I think before, if we're really going to be serious, we need to start with the institutions, we start with the cultural. And the big cultural change we're going to have to change, well, not change, but improve, is a can-do attitude. So, like, the Japanese have this in the culture, and they don't like the word no. So I think, just like the movie Yes, you know, the Yes Man, I think we should practice saying yes no matter what. Someone asks you in the tech world to do something, there's no such thing as no anymore, okay? And that's big on your investors too. You don't have an excuse to say no anymore. It's yes, and then if you get a bit scared halfway down, well then start learning yourself a bit and see if you can make the company successful if you're an investor. But no more no's. So that's rule one. We are no longer a no people. We are a yes people, and we say yes, and how can I? So it's a can-do attitude. No such thing as a no anymore. Whatever it is, pretty much whatever it is. And quite frankly, I've lived like this. There's not much I haven't done around the world, and it's been amazing. I mean, I've, you know, been in London and offered things, and do you want to fly over to Belgium with someone you've just met? Yep. Okay, would you like to work here? Yep. Yep, yep, yep. Pretty much never said no. Really not a fan of no's, to be honest. Yeah. So let's just get that part of the culture. We say yes to everything, and if we start to regret saying yes, because we said, yeah, I'll mortgage my house to fund your widget, or I'll work for you for 5 days on your app, or yes, I will learn this new AI algorithm for my boss because he wants to put that into our product rollout. Always to your boss is, yes, boss, I will learn that. Yes, 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 three bags full. And then after you said yes, then go and do the hard part of working out, damn, I don't know how AI works, and now I'm just a junior tech, but I'm now going to have to learn it. So that's on you, New Zealand. No more no's. All right, number one. Number two, we need to cultivate a electronics industry in the fundamentals. And we've got some bright areas of that. Of course, we've got Tate doing really well, Fisher and Paykel. But one thing that I went, when I was reading Steve Jobs' book, was how easy it was for him to get electrical engineers who were already building microchips in his town, you know. Now, in Silicon Valley, what was a little bit maybe not known about this too much is a lot of it was funded by the military. Now, not saying we should go directly down that path, but, you know, a lot of Hewlett-Packard, for example, was funded by big military projects. So they were building what was called oscillators, you know, for the submarines and radar. So that's sort of, they had the knowledge, and they had the factories pumping out, you know, microchips and circuit boards, so that when sort of Steve Jobs came along, they could just sort of use the same tech and modify it. So we need to cultivate an actual electronics industry. And I think the way I think that needs to happen is that rather than just all electronics in New Zealand being a theoretical field of study, and then it needs to be a much more hands-on, making circuit boards, printing the damn things out, and at least having one factory that, you know, will, you can sort of turn up and get your circuit board printed on. And I think however that looks, and potentially there's some military budget could go into this, but an area where these day in, day out, qualified electrical engineers, you know, stamping out microchips on a circuit board. Because, you know, very hard to innovate, let's say, purely in software, because if you really want to innovate, you normally innovate on the fundamentals as well, which is the electronics. And of course, that's where, you know, the iPhone was so revolutionary, because an iPhone was the combination of interesting software and interesting ways of doing circuitry. So that's, we need the fundamentals of an electronics industry. And that might literally mean that libraries, for example, start doing more Arduinos as part of their little resources, maybe doing come in on Saturdays and build your own circuitry. Maybe Motat needs to start doing that more electronics. Maybe universities need to start bringing in actual fabrication machines, so that it's too much theoretical, and start actually, you know, pumping out even maybe a basic integrated circuit. So much more hands-on, because, you know, what we are in the world now is we're kind of sick of people that talk. We want doers. And to be successful in electronics, it's all very good just to have, you know, these kind of concepts of what would be embedded microchip, more efficient transistor. But, you know, someone's actually got to get the wire, the copper, the steel, the nickel, and stick it in a little machine and press it. And if we don't have those fundamentals, we're always just going to be sort of hoping to get into the technology race. And we are behind. So, you know, this is... So tell your friends this. Tell this important people. So fundamental electronics industry. And I would suggest that, you know, we could even use some of our military engineering to be doing that. Actually have, you know, we used to have a Ministry of Works, but potentially we could have a Ministry of sort of technology, which is, you know, making certain parts that we use in New Zealand, you know. It could even be certain things for our fishing industry that New Zealand government funds to make, you know, detecting underwater things. But, yeah, so that's we've got to have at least an area of day-in, day-out electrical engineers, because they are the people that generally will make, you know, it's like having a whole lot of architects without any builders in a country. They all get two crazy ideas and, you know, nothing works. You've got to have those people that have hands-on experience in tech to make it a successful product. Okay? So that's number two. So we have number one is no more no. Number two is, so we always say yes to no matter what. So you can even try it today, people. Go through your day today. Whatever the question is, it's yes. number two is potentially a government-funded, university-funded, military-funded electronics staple industry. So we're at least making some widgets, some circuitry stamped out every day, day in, day out, and that will always have a pool of graduates going in, graduates coming out, senior engineers coming in, senior engineers going out, and you need that to be able to really, quite frankly, even consider being part of, you know, the developed world, quite frankly. But that's one. Number three is we have to, so the institutions, the other institution, okay, so here's the number three one, intellectual property. This needs to be taught at school. Lawyers, this is on your heads. You need to start helping the culture understand the value of IP. Get it into the dialogue. Get it into the lexicon. Stop holding on to that as a hidden treasure. Make people aware of what IP is, what patents are, what utility patents are, and the value of this. Do a booklet, publish that bloody thing, and get it into the library so people understand. My God, yeah, wow. So ideas are valuable. What's in your head is valuable. Make it accessible. Just like how the IT industry's made so many things accessible, let's hope the lawyers can make IP easy, you know. You know, maybe a little app. You know, run this wizard to see if your app can be patented, you know. Call this number now and we'll send you a kit on how to do an IP. But we have to learn about IP as a culture and we have to start using it. As a country, we are the most lucky country in the world to be able to do intellectual property. So why is that? Well, we're all free thinkers, we're all imaginative, and we're protected by all the big countries if we do create IP. So generally, if New Zealanders come up with an intellectual patent, even though we're a small little country, we basically get all the protection of America and Australia and Europe when we, you know, do go through the process. So, you know, once it's IP, it's protected, and it's ridiculous we're not pushing that. So, yeah, IP is part of our culture. Now, that needs to happen, I think. So I did a Bachelor of Science, and first year is all maths and chemistry, and it's all good. The fact that they didn't have a part of that is what IP is and how to go about it, there should be, quite frankly, heads roll on that because you're doing a Bachelor of Science. The idea is you'll graduate and become, you know, potentially an innovator in maybe your field, but you don't even know what IP is. So, it's silly because without knowing it, you might be working, for example, writing MATLAB algorithms and detecting new formulas for finding quarks or an anti-quark. When you're telling all your friends, you don't realise that what you've got is potentially patentable. And, of course, once you release an idea to the domain, to the world, you can't patent it. So, you know, so these are things that, you know, as soon as you start a Bachelor of Science, you know, day one, right, guys, you're going through this course. We're going to tell you that if you're working on a great idea, you come up with something, don't tell all your friends about it. Go through a formal process of getting a patent. So, yeah, so that needs to be happening. It also needs to be in the media. The media need to understand what IP is. It needs to become part of our culture. Like we all understand sports, we're good at sports. We need to understand intellectual property. We need to know the value. We need to know how it's done. So I'll give you a couple of secrets that sort of annoy some people. You can get a provisional patent, annoying the lawyers, yourself by going to the government IPONS office. And a provisional patent in New Zealand is one of the cheapest in the world. It's only like $300 or $400. And a provisional patent is when you've got the concept of your idea, you're working it out, you haven't quite actually put it into a workable product. You haven't got that circuit board printed. But you just know that as you're telling your engineer friends, you're thinking, well, look, they could kind of take my idea. So what you do, as soon as you've gone and got the concept, you write as much information as you think will be about it, what it will do, how it will look, draw the circuit board, come up with as much as you can, post that down to Wellington with a little form, $400, you get a provisional patent. Now, here's the secret that the legal profession, I don't think, want to let you know on, that just by doing that, you've got a protection almost in every country in the world on that idea. Basically, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but basically for a couple of years. And what it means is that if a company goes, oh, wow, yeah, we like that idea. Well, they can't really do it. And how it works is once you've finished coming up with your idea, your big concept, and your little circuit board, after the 2 years, it's working. It's a workable product. Oh, my God, you know, this really works. You can start splashing that on YouTube and multimedia, going, look at what I've done, everybody. I'm the best. I'm the best. And before the wolves at the door come and say, yeah, well, we're going to take the idea, you go, yeah, I got a provisional patent. And then you spend the $100,000 to the lawyer to do a full patent. And it backdates the patent date to the day that you started the provisional patent. And this is an incredible proxy for good ideas, because if your idea in those 2 years turns out, oh, you know what, I didn't know what I was doing, it's a waste of time, then you've just wasted $400, no big deal. If your idea becomes useful, then you'll, by that time, have the ability to say, look, I've already got customers for this. I can sell this to Samsung right now, and they will say, yes, you could sell it to us, but you've got a provisional patent. Damn, yeah, you can sell it to us because we can't take that idea. You've got a $400 provisional patent. So the fact that, yeah, that's what we need to be doing. And, you watch Dragon's Den, they spend millions on, well, hundreds of thousands on patents, when a provisional patent will often do. Okay? So, yeah, and then it gets backdated to that date. So number one, we should be teaching IP law. Well, number three, that is. So we'd be teaching IP law. It's part of our culture, understanding it. And it's not just verbatim, you know, learning the legal jargon. It's understanding how it gets value. How, for example, and so another secret, because I kind of like my audience. Let's say you'd come up with a widget for a better lawn, automated lawnmower that detects kakuri grass and doesn't, you know, only cuts kakuri grass and not the nice grass on your golf course. Let's say you come up with an AI for that, okay, and you stick it on a lawnmower and it's did. So you get your provisional patent, $400, you draw the lawnmower, you write down how it all works, then you go off to your engineering friends and you sort of get it all set up. Then you go, hang on, well, if it's been a year on it, things it's going to work. So how do I make money out of that at that point? You're a little Kiwi, you know, you're a Kiwi farmer. And, you know, you've kind of put, you know, not hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands into sort of making the lawnmower work and sort of, it sort of works, you've drawn it out. You know, what you do then, you go, well, look, got the professional patent, got the number, you put your suit on, hire one, get one from the op shop, and you walk down to Masport, book a meeting, you say, look, I've got this lawnmower now that can detect different grasses and won't cut the others. I've got a provisional patent. Would you like to have the rights to this if I fully patent it, or would you like to patent it and we'll share it? And they'll go, oh, I don't know about that. And you go, that's fine, you're Massport. And then you go off to Yamaha. You say, Yamaha, would you like to get this patent? And I say, oh, well. Then you go, well, look, now I've got something that all the industry wants, but I own the IP, well, the provisional to it. So what's it worth to one of these lawnmower manufacturers? And one of them will go, well, you know what, for Yamaha, it's not hard for us to get the patent. So, yeah, well, let's why don't you set up a company and we'll buy the whole rights to it, and we'll be the only lawnmower that will be able to detect different kinds of grass. Boom. And they'll give you a nice check and you walk away without making one bloody lawnmower. So that's how a provisional patent can get your money in your pocket. And as a country, you basically have the provisional, you go off to the industry and you say, this is the deal, and if you don't like it, I'm going to go to your competition, and you do that, and you get the best deal. Okay? And you can do that with any widget and pretty much any software for $400 in Wellington. And most of us don't know that, I can tell you that, because it took me a while to find out. Yeah, so that's IP. And so we need to learn, like, again, it's not just learning it, it's knowing how to apply it, all the little ways of doing it. Even the basics, for example, now, when you draw something, if you're doing a mechanical design, I mean, it's all very good to, you know, spend lots of money on AutoCAD, design it all and stuff. But if you are a provisional patent, another secret, should know this, is, you know, Google offer these little SolidWorks and, well, not SolidWorks, excuse me, Sketch and these 3D modeling tools now, where almost anyone can basically just grab them. That's all good. So yeah, that's basically how the, you know, we need to change it to not just being, you know, something, oh yeah, IP, you kind of heard about that. Don't you have to be really smart to go and actually give it a go? Because yeah, and using these tools, like these 3D design tools that are free, you can just download them like from Google, you often can get a pretty good 3D model of what you're trying to build. And when you're doing a provisional patent and a patent, all these things, it's all about not necessarily being perfectly engineered. You know, it's about holding up in court as if if the competition ever challenged you and said, oh, no, that's too close to our idea. We're going to challenge that. So at the end of the day, all your design has to meet is the ability to convince effectively a panel of lawyers that your design is unique and original. So, yeah, so IP is not outside the remit of anyone with a laptop. Okay, so, you know, there's 3D tools for designing things. You can design circuitry on the internet now. That's free. You can get, for example, modular circuitry boards. You can get open source. And so if you're going to come up with an idea, provisional patent it, Bob's your auntie, okay? So that's part three of our cultural change. Cool. Okay. Next thing. A little bit more on that again. So the IP is, so it needs to be, again, sort of taught almost. I think all libraries should be really putting big part of their library, not just in more, you know, health books and diet books, but a whole section on, you know, engineering and IP, and maybe even applications right there on filling in a patent, maybe Arduinos in the library, maybe even some nice coloured posters, so even children can almost see what would happen with IP. Okay, and needs to be at school, and needs to be, I mean, the fact that it's not at university is just, makes me so angry, quite frankly, that a whole science degree, you don't learn about it. But yeah, and then it needs to be, the media need to be, you know, when they're questioning people that come on that are, you know, obviously not Rocket Lab because they're, you know, they're well ahead. But, you know, when they're questioning people on, oh, great, so you're working at this Infinterra and your job is to increase the milk yield. And so what is the, what are the patents you're applying for on that? What? Yeah, what are the patents you're applying for that? And get it into the lexicon of people. So that's on you, media. Mike Hoskin. Yeah, learn IP. All right. That's so 1, 2, 3. So the first part of the culture is never say no. Second part of the culture is getting electrical fundamentals part of our country going. Number three is getting the IP understood as part of our culture. University, schools, media, TED Talks, for example, should be always on one of our, you know, pretty crappy TV channels on Freeview. The fact that TED Talks, I believe that this should be streamed on one of our free-to-air channels. You know, we've got a whole lot of, you know, rubbish channels, let's be honest, on Freeview, cooking shows, rip them off and just stream 24/7 TED Talks on one of those. You know, update our IQ as a nation, and no more excuses. Okay, so four, what's the next part of our cultural change? Four is money, people. And I think we need to be, and I think it's almost an asset in New Zealand that we are generous and we don't really care about money or really making it so much. But and what we seem to do, now, if you don't fit into this field, then so what? But if you're making a widget in New Zealand, we normally go, how can we compete by making it cheap? It's generally almost how we go with making technology is, how can we make it cheaper? All right, and so please, no more of that. We do not make widgets or technology cheap. Waste of time. We're a little country. That's never where we'll be able to compete in IP or the technology field. All right, we need to be novel, unique, and quite frankly, if you're wondering about your next idea, or your IP, or your business model, or what part of the technology you can produce, first thing actually you should ask is, what is the best profit margin? What is the most highest priced thing I can sell the world? So rule one is, let's flip this money thing in New Zealand around 180 degrees. What is the most expensive thing I can sell? Okay, and what is the biggest margin? And work down from there. So it's almost, you know, like the Swiss. All right, well, we'll sell really expensive watches that really don't cost that much to make. So that's, yeah, that's how we have to do it. We have to go, you know, we're certainly not going to make a compete with, for example, the Android industry by making a cheaper Android phone, are we? But maybe we can, you know, what is the, this is just literally the top of my head, but, you know, what, is there a market for jewelry phones, you know, gold-plated, you know, silver and diamond Android phones, and only sell them to, you know, the top celebrities for $500,000 each, yeah, and we just sort of effectively put the circuitry in that's off the shelf. You know, that's the thinking, is high price and then work down. That should almost be one of our rules. So money, money, money. Let's talk about that. So the big thing is when you're doing your IP or you're in business, you're doing your technology, and as a country, we cannot just be keep thinking how nice it is to make technology, how nice it is. It's got to have money coming in. And if you're not, you are basically saying to all the younger people, I don't care about you. You won't get your foot on the ladder because I've just got enough money to get by, and when you grow up, there won't be an industry for you. So go pick fruit. So your job, if you're working in the tech field, is to be making a lot of money so the next people can come up and they can innovate as well. You can be buying machines. You can be, you know, buying the expensive technology so that people can get in. So how does that work? So the first thing that works is that when we're making a widget, and I've talked about this before, a widget is sort of really, in my mind, a box of electronics that does something, okay? Or we're making software, or a combination of those two. We need to be, number one, writing down the streams of money that will be coming into that. And I think we get too optimistic about hoping someone will buy a widget, hoping there'll be just a market. And that is, like, it's something like 90%, 99 times, no, there isn't. No one will. So who's going to buy it? And what are the multiple revenue streams? Because I've said on a previous show, if you're making a widget or software, if you should have minimum 5 revenue streams. And if you can't think of 5, well, I'm on LinkedIn, and I might even do it for a hug and a beer, because I can normally think of, you know, maybe 500 revenue streams on many widgets. But you need a 5. You need, obviously, normally you're selling the widget, so there's a sales price. There's a bundling fee, so you might bundle someone else's third-party software and get revenue. There's maybe a license fee to let people use it as part of another product. Maybe you sell different versions of the product. Maybe you get data from your customer and sell the data. Maybe you're it's part of a big project. Maybe you're getting donations. Maybe you're using it as a sort of a Trojan horse to sell other products. But right from the beginning, how can you get multiple revenue streams? Okay, and as a country, we need to be, you know, selling our technology when we get there. Not just we sold it, goodbye customer, but, you know, license fees. I mean, look at Microsoft. You never stop paying for Microsoft Word. I just can't believe that. You know, you buy it once, and then every year you're paying, you know, the update fees, subscription fees, or antivirus. So you buy a laptop these days, you pay for the actual price of it. Then you obviously you always buy an upgraded stuff. Then you buy your warranty, and then every month you're using the silly virus software. Oh, give us some more money to update this virus software. And we're all idiots, and we all do it. And those companies are reaping it in. And so, you know, multiple revenue streams, okay? And they're taking your data, a lot of these laptops too, if you read the terms and conditions. So, multiple revenue streams. And, and be real about it. And then, of course, the trick to getting these revenue streams is employing a good salespeople, you know, and then we do have them in New Zealand, good salespeople that effectively can create those relationships with the international clients to buy our technology and sign up these agreements. You know, it's got to be, you know, generally, if we get into the tech world, a lot of it needs to be, you know, ongoing revenue licenses, for example. Okay, next thing. All right, so that's our cultural thing, part of it. And, again, IP is part of our culture. Electronics industry, quite frankly, that probably could just be the Air Force getting into that when they're not spending the money on aeroplanes. So why not set up a fabrication and start punching out circuit boards that, for example, can detect illegal driftnet setting, driftnet phishing, for example. Punch those out in a factory, get those circuit boards soldered up, and be selling them to every single country in the world that wants to be spotting underground phishing or something, you know. Some no-brainers. We should really be pushing out what we do, sort of in the government institute, the money to do it to get that, you know, the hard electronics. You got to have, again, the fundamental electronics going because it just breeds into the conversation of a country. It's not necessarily just about that one circuit board. It's the fact that there's all the culture around it, okay? And again, that's what, you know, made some of early Silicon Valley. All right, so next thing. All right, so let's get into what we're naturally good at in New Zealand if we, you know, change our culture. So areas, okay? And I guess I'm pretty blunt, but, you know, life's short, and we've all heard sports on the radio bashing our brains every day, so, you know, a bit of this is fun. So let's get into what we are naturally really good at and we can really innovate in. Number one, marine engineering, marine science, marine technology, marine software, marine widgets, marine electronics, marine. We can own that naturally. First of all, just on the basics, if you're making circuitry for the marine industry, it's generally a much higher caliber than consumer electronics. And so what I'm talking there is you don't necessarily need to make a huge amount of them, but they all need to be corrosion free and, you know, spec'd high. So marine technology, we should not. So if you're even making sails right now as part of the boat industry, or or even painting boats. Have a coffee meeting and write down a whiteboard of literally 2,000 things that the marine industry needs in technology. Because there's probably 100,000. So come up with 2,000, pivot your business. And like I say, remember, there's no such thing as no. So it's pick one of those and don't be scared. The industry, and technology is not as hard as you think. It's, like I say, electronics is a mature industry. Not much hasn't been done in the fundamentals. Software now, almost any teenager can write, a basic software app if you give them exactly what to do. You know, they can Google the things they don't know, quite frankly. All right. So marine, yes. Yeah, so it could be things, obviously, you know, navigation was one, fishing is one, but, you know, weather forecasting is a big one. Automatic steering of boats, you know, control, pitch control, maybe, you know, the health and safety, you know, there's corrosion detection, engine detection. I mean, what part of marine industry doesn't need technology? I mean, let's be honest, even an inflatable dinghy, you would probably like to know where you were and, you know, maybe... the pressure of the air inside. I mean, it could be a widget just for that. But the marine industry, so that's number one we're good at, and maybe I'll come back to that because it's so big. And we're not going to build ships. We're not certainly going to build oil tankers in New Zealand, and none of us want to. We don't want to have a, you know, Marsden Point converted to thousands of tons of iron like, you know, some of the older countries were doing in the Industrial Revolution. But a nice modern building in downtown with a whole lot of latte drinkers designing circuitry to help these ships, well, then, you know, we're really getting somewhere as a country. And again, the media need to be pushing this, you know, please. Right. So then we have, so that's marine. That's huge. And there's so many facets of it. Number two is flight technology. Okay. So, we are lucky in New Zealand. We are quite regulation-free around certain flight technology. And, of course, that's why Rocket Lab's doing so well. But even just in the small aircraft technology, we can do quite well on that. Is that we've got a natural affinity for sort of creative thinking and the joy of flight and the, you know, we rely on flight. We train hundreds of pilots in New Zealand. We're really good at that. So let's get some intellectual property around that, you know. Maybe some software that designs aeroplanes. So let's not design aeroplanes. Let's design the software that designs aeroplanes. Maybe better IP around, you know, landing planes. Maybe better ways of detecting when too many planes are coming to the airport. But let's get those whiteboard meetings. Let's not talk about what's on TV. Let's write every week in your little, you know, if you're running a, even if you're doing a pilot school right now, sit down and think, what does the aviation need? 2,000 on your whiteboard. None of you go home until that's done, right? Right. So that's your flight industry. So that's big. It's probably not as big as marine, but we do have a natural affinity to flight. You know, we've made some great planes in New Zealand. We train a lot of pilots. So if we can get some IP in there and, you know, software for training pilots, for God's sake, you know, they could be using that around the world or, yeah, really big on that. And it's not always making the software even or making the widget. It's getting the license to the patent, all right? Paper is light. Making widgets is often heavy. You have to put in a crate and send it when you can just say to an American company, oh, we understand you're wanting to design a better soundproof airport. Well, we've got the software to do that, and here's a subscription based, and we'll sit comfortably in our office while you pay us lots. Number three is recreation and sports and entertainment software. Okay? We should be the world leader in that. So this is not games. This is not just point-and-shoot games we're making. This is things like augmented reality for improving sports, maybe ways of adding value to your ski field by using IP and augmented reality and maybe some entertainment value. For example, you're running a ski field and whoever skis a certain over a certain trail, there's some virtual gold. And because your software detected they'd done that, bang, that person got a free ski trip the next day because there's a little app on everyone's phone. Maybe the app says who's done the most skis for the day, who did the fastest trail. Get that app made if you're a ski field. Get onto it now. Again, I got only 100 trillion of these ideas in my head, but anyway. So sports recreation, smart balls even, believe it or not. You know, balls on your you're playing a game of tennis and they have some little circuitry inside the tennis ball that works out if the hit was correct, or the tennis racket, you had the right stroke, or your golf ball. Sports needs technology. You need widgets. It needs electronics and it needs software. So we should be the world leaders in that. Which a whole huge office block in downtown doing sports software. Okay, so there's not just the utilitarian aspect, there's the entertainment aspect. You know, how can you make cricket more fun? I mean, there's a winner. You know, have some sort of app where, you know, the cricket bat's actually smart and maybe it, I don't know, maybe there's some clever little things where, I mean, look, top of my head here, you know, maybe, let's be honest, cricket's so boring that when they hit the ball, everyone watching the game has augmented sunglasses on and there's a whole lot of goblins also on the field and every now and then the cricket ball hits one, boom, and the batter gets an extra point. I mean, look, trust me, I haven't put my mind to that. And, you know, there's lots of people that know sports, recreation. So that's number three. Number four is something we've already started doing. We can do better. And that's wireless intellectual property. Wireless. All right. So we're all upset about 5G. But wireless is still fairly burgeoning technology. You know, Nokia patented Bluetooth. Australia effectively patented Wi-Fi. So if you're working at a university now, put down your lunch, get back to your office, drop what you're doing, come up with, within 24 hours, some better wireless intellectual property. Okay? So, it's not rocket science. Wireless is a huge world. Wireless power, for example, is going to be a big area where we can charge things wirelessly. Maybe there's some big areas in New Zealand we can push that. Maybe we incorporate charging something wirelessly with a data transfer as well. So you put your phone on the table, charges power, but it's also updating its software because we're pushing the data through the wireless. Maybe we're using GSM and we're triangulating it better. Maybe we come up with a better triangulation for just Wi-Fi. Maybe someone comes up with a way of using different layers in TCP for triangulation. I mean, I won't lie, I spend my mind on 10 minutes of stuff. I come up with probably 20,000 ideas in the wireless world. But that's what we can do. We can really be the world leaders in wireless. Not many countries are innovating that much in wireless. I mean, obviously, some countries, you know, the AI is where, you know, a lot of industry is going. But wireless is a big area. We do have fairly good scientists already working in that. It's just a matter of now, you know, turning that into commercialization, some commercial IP. So, yeah, push that. All right. So then there's a couple of other things that are not specific industry, but that we can be very good at. And that's because it's kind of who we are as people. And it's an area that we can really excel at. And you see this when Saatchi & Saatchi get awards for their advertising. And it's because we have some great creative thinkers in the sort of creative arts world. You know, that's why obviously we do great in the movie industry. They're doing great. But there's another area that I think they're missing. And I think Weta might even get into this, or D&B or Saatchi & Saatchi, for example. And that's UX. Okay, UX, we could be the leaders in UX in the world. And I really mean this sincerely, okay? You know, I've done a bit of travel, I guess you know, I'm talking a little bit like a bit of a know-it-all, but UX is an area, where really we could be the best. It's not been worked out. UX is being left as a side note for most companies, and it is so important. And we have the gift of creativity. And the big thing about UX, I'll give you the secret, the big thing is humanity, culture, and understanding the human condition. UX is not for nerds, really. Nerds, you know, and I'm saying this in sort of a nice way. Engineers don't want to be involved with UX, all right? Advertisers, like, for example, people that sort of put your ads on, you know, your magazines, are scared to get into UX. And if they do, they don't really get into the deep data analytics of UX. But UX is effectively customer user experience. It's the fuzzy gray world between engineering and creativity. It is that sweet spot. It is what made Apple a $2 trillion company. Mixing good engineering with customer experience. It's not just making nice, pretty logos too. It's deep. There's lots of layers to it. It's many layers of psychology. But the big thing why we'd be good at it is it's literally just understanding people, how people tick, what makes people use a product, how do they people fall in love with a product, all right? It's an emotional thing. And we could be very good at this. So if we start getting much more into UX, you know, there's a lot of companies that do good engineering, good software, and they fail because they're unusable. Okay, it's ridiculous. I mean, some fantastic scientific softwares and brilliant things, but no matter what, people want a product that's fun to use, easy to use. Obviously, you know, there's this new thing, gamification of things, but it all comes into this thing called UX or user experience. We could be writing books on it, quite frankly. In fact, we should be. If you're in that area, please write a book on it. It is a new area. It's picked up a bit. Google started really noticing how important this is and really putting a lot of energy into it. Apple almost stumbled onto UX just because Steve's insane passion for design. But now, you know, but a lot of companies still are leaving UX out of their apps. And it's a layer. It really is. It's a layer above, on top of the software, on top of the engineering. And it's not just marketing. In fact, marketing can ruin user experience. So, yeah. So UX is something we can really push. It's all really fun. It's all about thinking outside the box sometimes. It's problem solving, but it's in a humanic way. It's using great design, great aesthetics, but having big respect for the engineers. So it's not a, you know, it's that nice understanding what the engineer needs the user to do. And if you just simply plonk UX or what we used to call user interface on top of a product, in the old days, you just sort of design a quick interface. That's not good enough these days. You need a deep user experience that makes the engineering come alive. As a country, we could be the best at that. It's all remote. You don't need the product physically in the country. You can be doing UX for almost anything. In New Zealand, most of it, we're sort of doing this a little bit with their team. They set up to design internal cabins, but it can be a physical thing too, but yeah, UX is big, big, big. We have a, you know, company right now in Texas that's doing bridge building software, but, you know, they have to work with a whole lot of plumbers that put in the data. Well, they get a company in Auckland off for stringing lattes going, we've come up a great way of how a plumber would enjoy playing a game sort of as they use your app. Okay? No excuses there. All right, so UX. So I've gone through quite a lot of things, huh? And I guess I was blunt to the point because life's short and, you know, money's good. And it would be nice that we really, really go hard on this area. Really push ourselves, get some widgets, sell the intellectual property so we can play golf and, you know, enjoy our lives. There is another part. I might as well do this, bash this area again, and that's you investors. the great thing about putting money into a software product is once, let's say I write a bit of software, okay, sure, there's some time involved. At a push of a button, I can replicate that software times 1 trillion copies. Can you do that with a house? So I write an app. Let's say it's really useful and helps dentists, for example, work out where the most, I don't know, where the filling's going to be in a tooth. Write that app. Oh, copy paste. I've replicated it. And that's the miracle, investors, of letting your tech people in, because you don't have to get concrete and pour a foundation and wait for it to set. With software, you can triplicate it. You can make millions of copies of software while you had a cup of tea. So if one bit of software was $100 to sell, you know, and that's just, I thought, was a no-brainer, but somehow investors find that hard to understand. But software is good investment if you get a real team of serious people. You can really nail it. Okay? So investors, yeah, I really hope that we are brave, it's risk, and we get all the money we've got, literally tomorrow, people, take it out of what we've got, knock on every door who is in the tech world and go, can you have all my money, please? Because you are doing something really amazing and I will get a better return because you can effectively copy it for infinity. So yeah, so investment needs to start maturing up, understanding the risk benefit of technology and being brave. We're only on this planet a short time. I'm surprised how conservative people are, quite frankly, but that needs to be a new cultural change too. In fact, might leave that for a whole other show to bash those investors. But yeah, get the money into startups and good tech. There are definitely some fakers, killing it for everybody. But yeah. But when we put all that together, we'll be really good people. So yeah, you've got update. That's been a pretty wild show. And I hope everybody can enjoy the rest of the day and tune in next week. Thank you. Don't forget the website, update.chat, if you need me. Thanks, guys. Anthony Blomfield.